Good morning. I want to welcome you to the U.S. Institute of Peace for this very important presentation. Before anything else, I will ask you to turn off your cell phones so you won't disturb the proceedings. I think you all know the basic outlines of the history and nature of the conflict in northern Uganda. It's a conflict, a war that's been going on for 20 years. Tens of thousands of people have been killed. Hundreds of thousands have been displaced into IDP camps, wretched camps, abductions, mutilations, horrors of a variety of kinds. And throughout much of this period, Betty Bagombe has been the key go-between. From 1988 to 1996, she was Minister of State in the office of the Prime Minister of Uganda, a member of the Ugandan cabinet, and a member of the parliament. And her major responsibility was to try to bring peace to northern Uganda. She then went to the World Bank for several years, and then for the past 2 years, up until last May, she was the chief mediator between the LRA and the Ugandan government. An independent mediator, but with support from the UN and several embassies. I visited Betty in Gulu about 18 months ago, and it was a remarkable experience for me. She had no office. She sat there in the dining room of a small hotel in Gulu, managing to juggle three cell phones as she's getting calls from President Museveni and from leaders of the LRA and trying to provide communication and bring some sanity to that insane situation. It truly has been amazing work that she is engaged in, and remarkable that she has stuck with it for all these years to try to bring peace. Among her many recognitions, she was named the Woman of the Year in Uganda in 1993. Rotary International gave her its Peace Award and several other recognitions of her important work. And the U.S. Institute of Peace is very proud and pleased to have Betty as a senior fellow here with us this year. And this is her first public presentation in Washington. And so I introduce Betty Bagombe.
Thank you very much. As David has said, this is the first major presentation I'm making since I joined the Peace Institute. And since I'm used to more talking to people who live in the bush, this is quite a change. Basically, I will walk you through what I have gone through since I got involved in mediating between the Lord's Resistance Army and the government of Uganda. Also, assuming that most of you are familiar with the situation, therefore I will not go into a lot of details as far as the war is concerned. LRA, or the Lord's Resistance Army, was one of the five factions that picked up arms to fight President Museveni when he came to power in 1986. Some of those factions were militarily defeated. One of them was Alice Lakwena. The other three were negotiated with and where they joined government and they were resettled. Then there was the Lord's Resistance Army, where the leadership, Joseph Kony, believes he has supernatural power. So when I was appointed Minister for Pacification and to live in the conflict area, my task was to persuade the Acholi people, this is the tribe, dominant tribe in northern Uganda, to persuade their sons to stop fighting. So government did not have the policy of peace talks. It was just persuade them so that they can give up fighting. It wasn't long before I realized that a military solution was not going to succeed. I realized that the Ugandan army had a huge economic benefit out of the war, and they were really not engaging LRA in combat operations. And therefore, I decided to persuade President Museveni that we needed to talk to the rebels. And also try to, it's not just talk to the rebels, but what was his interest? What incentives did he have to allow me to opt for a peace for peace talks as opposed to persuading the rebels to give up fighting? In that, then persuading him to see the importance of talking peace, that he would realize sustainable peace. He asked me to go on talking to the rebels. But even then, his position was negotiate for surrender. It was not only that. I saw that there was not going to be a military solution to the conflict. But I also realized that the Acholi people had issues. It was unfortunate that they had the Lord's Resistance Army fighting. This is Sitia. Fighting, but there are issues that needed to be addressed. And as far as I'm concerned, I thought this offered an opportunity for talks, which would in turn also address some of the underlying causes of the conflict in northern Uganda. This therefore culminated to the 1993-1994 peace talks with the rebels. And here, we're talking about a typical cult-like organization without any clear political agenda that I had to talk to. So the first meeting with the Lord's Resistance Army, in fact, with the leadership, exposed me to some very bizarre activities, the kind of belief they had. They poured all kinds of oil on me so that if I had other intentions, it would be cleansed. So what issues are you going to place on the table for that, especially when I had my own hidden agenda that the peace talks would allow us to address underlying causes of the conflict? Because Joseph Kony's concern, number one, was issues that we discussed was his own security. It was not the security, it was not just with government, but his many victims. How was he going to live with them? What kind of protection was going to be provided to him? It was also economic means of livelihood. And as far as he was concerned, he didn't want to be a president. He wanted to continue preaching for the Ten Commandments. He also believes he is a gifted person that can heal using herbs, including HIV/AIDS. In fact, he was telling me most of my commanders are infected, but I've managed to prolong their lives using the herbs. So these were the only issues, which was quite frustrating, that he placed on the table. Now, unfortunately, even as we agreed to sign peace agreement, taking into consideration issues that he had raised, on a date agreed upon and a place agreed upon, President Museveni came in, gave ultimatum, 7 days. The war, he was not going to accept any more peace talks. He was opting for a military solution and gave 2 weeks. Unfortunately, everything fell apart and also promised the war would end in 2 months' time. The lessons I learned from all this was that as a government cabinet minister, then I had political clout. I could manage to call President Museveni and discuss issues and sometimes persuade him and convince him to accept certain things that I wanted to do or that I thought was right. The other thing was LRA did not enjoy support anymore from the population. As I said earlier on, there were 5 different factions. So LRA was just one of the many, and they wanted a change of government. One would wonder, too, why would LRA trust me to mediate between them and the government when I was a government official? Well, it could also be the fact that I'm an Acholi, the same tribe as them. But the other thing, too, they believed I could deliver on Museveni. They believed Museveni trusted me, and therefore I could manage to persuade him so that they could have soft landing. The other factor that contributed to this was that the government of Sudan, which eventually took over and gave LRA sanctuary and provided weapons, was not yet a player at the time. So this helped the situation. The factors, however, against that initiative at that time was the incentives to deal with the Ugandan army that were benefiting from the army a lot. There was no incentive. If the war ended, and indeed the 6 months without war, they were already having a very hard time because war allowance was not coming. Gas, trucks that they would ravage and build their own or sell off were not coming. So the army kept working against that initiative to persuade President Museveni that it was not going to lead anywhere. I also felt more hostility among the truly senior officers. In fact, my sense is that psychology of people who are at war or people who feel marginalized is that they start fighting one another because one looks at you like you have they're in search of power, they're in search of recognition, and consequently they fight somebody who should be their own ally. I had a lot of problems to deal with senior Acholi people in the army. I was also naive that I did not pay attention to the spoilers because my assumption was who would want this war to continue? But there were very many people who were misinforming the Lord's Resistance Army and at the same time informing government so that the process eventually failed. I did not create allies between the different groups, whether civil society organizations, NGOs. I thought this was not a huge problem. Now I look back, if I had created allies among different groups, maybe they would have acted as pressure groups. Maybe they would have provided some protections. I did not also involve members of the international community back then. Because I thought this is a very local issue and we could deal with it. And yet they could have acted as a pressure group. These were some of the lessons I learned within that phase. And of course, as I said earlier on, it failed. Museveni gave ultimatum, and it did not work. So 1996, I left the government, left the country to go to school in this country, but maintained contact with the Lord's Resistance Army. In between, there had been other initiatives. One of the most the well-known one was by the Carter Center. We're lucky to have Joyce New here, who was then the task manager for that initiative. And she invited me to join the team. Now, then came 2004, 2006. I tried to forget it, but the suffering continued. We knew there were 2 million people in the camps. Now, it was an incident in 2003. I watched on television screen, in fact I was getting ready to go to Burundi on World Bank mission, that there was this gruesome picture on the screen. LRA had just massacred over 200 people. So my immediate sense was that this cannot go on forever. So I contacted President Museveni, contacted the LRA, and asked if they wanted to talk. And this is the initiative that culminated to the December 2004 first face-to-face meeting between the Lord's Resistance Army and the LRA and the government of Uganda. Two government ministers attended. again, in here, the challenge is LRA continues to be a cult-like group without any clear political agenda. So it's very, very difficult to know, you know, what should be the issues that should be tabled on the that should be put on the table. Although the government of Sudan was no longer providing military weapons, and also thanks to the governments of United States, Britain, and several other Western governments that had put a lot of pressure on the government of Sudan to stop providing sanctuary and weapons to the Lord's Resistance Army. So again, in here, when this initiated or proposed to them to talk peace, they were keen to talk peace because they no longer had a base, and they were not sure of any more supplies. They were not sure either of who their friends continued to be. The peace talks between the government of Sudan and the Sudan People's Liberation Army was also another motive that they saw in it, that if they are talking a war that had gone on for almost 23 years, why can we not talk? So that was another motive. But in this initiative, I no longer had that political clout that I used to have as a government minister. And therefore, it was more difficult to convince Museveni. Again, I had to play on what was his interest in there. We're looking at the economic, the war has been a drain, economically draining on the country, on the government, and also his image, and how he would benefit if the 2 million people in camps were productive members of the community. So these were the factors that persuaded him to allow that. The other thing on the side of the LRA, of course, lack of proper support. On the one hand, ICC had already indicted some of them. So the challenges in all this is President Museveni, while he agreed to talk, but also said, we're going to use a two-pronged approach. That is, you continue talking, but we'll continue fighting. And that complicated things. Although I must add in here that he did grant ceasefire several times. The other thing was, which one time I said, is that next time I mediate, I will start by mediating among mediators, because with huge proliferation of mediators, it creates a lot of confusion. The competition causes confusion, prolongs the process, and even undermines it. And then you have also the different interest groups. This war had lasted a long time. I talked of economic benefit as far as the army was concerned. But there was also there were also civil society organizations and NGOs living off the war. So because, you know, they're turning to the UN agencies, they're turning to USAID, they're turning to different donor countries that they had contact with the rebels. And this had gone on and on and on. And then I come in, and that tap is turned off. So are they happy with the process, or are they going to undermine it? But I was wise at this time that although I knew they were really not happy because their means of livelihood had been turned off, but at the same time, could we work together, go for the meetings? Could you meet the president? Could you act as a pressure point? Can you go overseas and create awareness of what we're doing to interest international community on this war that had benefited, had literally not benefited from international community? The other thing was the role of the international community. Each donor country had other international organizations had their own constituency. There was some element of rivalry too, that one country wanted to take the lead over the other, and that had to be dealt with. The other thing was, of course, spoilers who went around and said, well, she's an agent of United States, she's an agent of the British, she wants to sell you. And then you have individuals who come to claim that they have contact with LRA, and could they be part of your team? It's very difficult to know who you can trust in that group and who you cannot trust, whether some of them are genuine or some of them are looking for opportunity for money. And all these groups or individuals you're dealing with is very time-consuming. It's also diversionary as you're trying to deal with the real issues. Of course, there was a lot of people also did not pull me away or looked at me from different lenses, that I was no longer in the government. So they still looked at me very much as a Museveni person. But I would not say that totally worked against me. It also helped to get LRA to think, well, we need somebody who Museveni can listen to. And so they continued to trust me, and we worked on. Then the role of the media. In here, what I would say is how irresponsible reporting can undermine a process. In fact, there were three different headlines in one, what one would say, government newspaper that undermined everything at one time. And when you get to that stage, it takes you several steps back. So it's very, very important that the media is taught on what to do and how to go about reporting. So much about that. So what are the prospects for peace the prospects for government of Uganda to sign an agreement with the Lord's Resistance Army? Everybody has described the ongoing peace talks in Juba as the best opportunity. I think the comprehensive peace agreement that the government of Sudan and SPLA signed has been a motivation for this process. Everybody wants to see peace in southern Sudan. Certainly President Museveni, who invested very heavily in SPLA, wants to see peace in southern Sudan. I'm seeing the same thing with the members of the international community more actively involved now, and they're talking about it, and they're providing all kinds of support. So I think all these make it possible that there will be a peace agreement. Furthermore, LRA poses regional instability. Since some of them relocated to Congo, and I remember vividly it was last year in October when President Museveni threatened to invade Congo if they did not fight LRA or throw LRA out. And that sent the international community panicking that should that happen, there would be war in the region. So there's more visible roles that members of the international community is playing. The arrest warrant by the ICC is another pressure point. LRA finally realizes that if they don't do something this time round, the whole world will be against them. So for the first time, I'm seeing that they're demonstrating more seriousness because of this. The other thing is the chief mediator from southern Sudan was at one time an ally of LRA, and of course, the other time he was also an enemy of them. So that gives him some upper hand in some ways. And as far as we know, the government of Sudan is no longer providing weapons. And Museveni also does now realize that northern Uganda has tainted his image, and he would like to correct that image. And therefore, he's showing more seriousness into the talks. But more, besides, of course, the fact that the war has been an economic drain, since the international community got interested in the situation in northern Uganda, there is whereby the the situation in the camps, the humanitarian situation in the camps have been exposed, has also, it's another push. But, and the Commonwealth Summit that will take place in Uganda in 2007 with over 50 heads of states attending, I'm sure he does not want to have anybody in the camps in his own backyard. That will not reflect well. What would be against the peace talks? Well, the other thing is LRA's intention is not yet clear. There are reported activities or other intentions that implicate they may just want to use this opportunity to regroup and rearm themselves. For example, there have been repeated messages or requests to them to at least release women and children so as to demonstrate that they're serious this time. This has not happened. The other thing that raises question mark is how representative of the LRA delegation in Juba of the LRA fighters in the bush. From time to time, the two contradict one another. So it's very difficult to know how representative they are. And then, of course, some of the unrealistic demands the LRA is making during the talks. Coupled with that is the inflammatory remarks being made by President Museveni from time to time that sends conflicting messages. Whether he's serious to is totally committed to the process or not, it nevertheless damages the process. And of course, finally, the arrest warrant hanging over Joseph Kony and the three senior commanders. So as far as that question is concerned, I would conclude by saying, yes, it's possible that the government of Uganda will sign peace agreement with the Lord's Resistance Army. The sticking point is, will it be implemented? We know examples of Angola where peace agreement was arrived at, but it was never implemented. This was between Savimbi and the government of Angola. We've seen a recent example of Sierra Leone where with Fodes Sanko, where a peace agreement was also arrived at, and it was never implemented. So the test is whether it will be implemented. But somehow, even if the talks are very fragile, there are lots of hurdles to go through. Somehow, I feel that some peace agreement will be arrived at, but the test is in the implementation. The third point is, what impact has the arrest warrant by the International Criminal Court had on the peace negotiation? Some of you would remember when I started, it was during the investigations, indictment, and I also, that was another group that I had to negotiate with quietly so that they could keep quiet. But nevertheless, we agreed they could continue with their investigation. But basically, the feeling was that they should give the peace process a chance. First of all, I would start by saying that without the arrest warrant, there would not be adequate pressure on LRA to be at the talks and continue. By now, probably they would have wanted to leave, would have given some excuses. So you can say that ICC is a deterrent, it is a stick for the LRA, and dropping the arrest warrant now would set a bad precedent, especially before LRA demonstrates its seriousness in talking peace. The other thing too, I would want to say this, that there's a lot of talk about is the arrest warrant an obstacle to peace? To this, I want to say that, first of all, when ICC announced that they were going to investigate this case and follow up. It was embraced by the people of northern Uganda. Everybody was happy about it. But the people of northern Uganda were extremely disappointed when they realized that ICC does not have its own forces. ICC instead turned to UPDF, the government army, to arrest the LRA. Now the question is, it has been the task of UPDF to arrest or kill LRA for the last 20 years. What makes you think, with another paper from you, they'll do it better? So this is just going to be another source of frustration and possibly another source of insecurity. Unless you have... So there's been a lot of confusion. Some people say, well, the people want peace and the case dropped. Before I came here, I visited 12 different camps to get the people's perception on what they really want about ICC. The message that came very, very clear to me was that we are craving for peace. We do not want any obstacle to peace. But we want this process sequenced. Can't we have peace first? And then ICC can continue with what they need to do. So my take in all this is that ICC should keep a low profile and wait and see how the whole peace process evolves. The other thing is, I probably will keep... How much time do I have?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Then the second point is, what motivates LRA? What keeps them together? This, if you start understanding the group, the spirit element in this, is you'd think they're crazy. But Konya's been able to hold his group together for 20 years, undefeated. So what is it that motivates them? In talking to many LRAs, whether it is a senior commander that has been very close to Kony, whether it is a child soldier, or whether it is a child mother, or even his own so-called wives, everybody believes that Kony has supernatural power. He's predicted so many things that have all happened, and therefore some even tell me, said, unless you understand the spirit, there's no way this war would end. So they totally believe, and even after they've come out, a lot of them do not speak freely because they're very, very cautious, believe Kony is somewhere listening to them. He has told them, he reads their minds, he sees what they're doing. Whether they defect or whether they stay with him, he knows exactly what's going on. So that belief has managed to hold LRA together. The other thing, of course, is brutality. If anybody tries to escape, the punishment is by death. And this has sent so much fear among them that some of them talking to them would tell you, even after they were wounded, they still try to find their way back to Kony. So there is that spirit that keeps them, that they're totally convinced about. And that has made Kony maintain his control over the group. But we also know that about 80% of LRAs were abducted children, captured in that period, at that age in time of transformation, that he has instilled certain beliefs in them that they cannot question. They totally believe in what he's saying. Then, of course, coupled with that, LRA abducts children, and the first assignment is go back, kill either member of your family or members of your own community. That way you have nowhere to go anymore. You remain with LRA, because having killed a member of your family or member of your community, how can you run away? Who do you go to, and where do you go? So they all remain remain with him and extremely loyal to him. The other factor, of course, is poverty. These children are abducted from abject poverty, where they're lucky probably if they get a meal in 2 days. So the moment they go, they join the rebel, the moment they're abducted, they immediately see opportunity. After all, they've seen, they've been into battles, they've won, and Kony had predicted it. And Kony has predicted so many things that have happened. He's also predicted he will take over government. And when he takes over government, there will be somebodies. So immediately, these people all see opportunity that, you know, a break away from that poverty they're coming to. And that makes them extremely loyal to him, and they fight to take, I mean, they exhibit a lot of courage, given what they do sometimes, like the belief in, when you talk to them, going back to the spirit, that stones really turn into bombs. You talk to somebody who is 35, has been with Kony for 10, 15 years, and totally tells you, no, 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 that stone, when you pick it up, you feel it. You feel something, it's like a machine, and when you throw it, you see the tail light. So they really turn into bombs. So these are the kind of things that has held LRA together. What have I learned from all this process? Some of them I'm simply repeating myself of what I had said earlier on. Competition among mediators needs to be addressed or controlled, because this, it certainly prolongs wars and undermines peace talks and causes a lot of confusion. If I look at other mediations, I think it was Bosnia, where a peace agreement could have been signed 2 years earlier. It took an extra 2 years because there were 9 different mediators. Commercialization of wars. This is whether you look at from what happened in Sierra Leone, where gold, diamond, kept funding the war, or whether you're looking at benefits that accrues directly to the military or to some of the players like NGOs and civil society organizations. What incentives is there if their means of livelihood is being cut off that can win them away from that and support a peace process? The other thing I learned too in the process was that, especially in the recent past, I spent too much time trying to please everybody, especially members of the international community. I wanted everybody to be happy. I wanted, I took a lot of time negotiating with them or trying to get them to understand why I was doing things a certain way, or trying to see why they could not be directly involved in the process. The other thing is, if I was to do it again, would I do it as an individual, or would I need an institute, a home, that I can belong to? Yes, this is what I would do, because that way I would be less vulnerable. There would be rules and regulations that could guide everybody. There would be strategies that would guide everybody, and therefore you don't get caught up in trying to appease different groups or individuals who want to be directly involved. The only downside with that is, how flexible would, if I belong to an institution, an institution also comes with rules and regulations as to what you can do and what you cannot do. So how flexible, how can I exercise my freedom to be able to do something if I'm tied up by rules and regulations that belongs to an individual, to an institution. Maybe what I would, what I've also learned is that the spirit element of the Lord's Resistance Army has never been factored into peace talks or even militarily. Although I did go to a crime profiler from Scotland Yard in Britain to try to understand this spirit, element of spirit. Deducing from what former LRAs did say, the crime profiler came up with something that I shared with them, and they all thought it was very, very true. Of Kony's want, he looks at himself as a god. He's so much used to power, and that's the other challenge on the peace talks will sign an agreement and come out and be an ordinary person, where he does not wield so much power, where he decides whether somebody should die, should eat, should, you know, that I'm seeing this already in the commanders who have come out. They're used to having so much power to decide whether somebody should be killed or they should cook in 30 minutes and they would, and that food would be ready in 30 minutes. Is this something that he can adjust to, when I'm seeing already a lot of difficulty with the commanders who have come out, who feel they have no power, they have no control. The servants, the people they used in the bush to do all kinds of things, can no longer do it for them, and they feel extremely uncomfortable about it. The other thing is that I learned is that even if you have not gone to the table, there ought to be some clear peace dividends that you can sell to the other side. What is there? Because we've seen so many other peace agreements that have not been implemented, that they even tell you that after excitement dies down, war is over. Nobody cares for them anymore. This can be built into peace talks, that they know that what I mean is that something should be happening already. For example, you have the case of Uganda. You have LRAs in thousands that have come out, that you do not have a comprehensive intervention to resettle them, to give them a means of livelihood. So that cannot work. That, in fact, I remember talking to the number two of LRA about it, because he was complaining that, well, if all these others are out and nothing is happening, and you've just thrown some girls into tailoring school, why should we come out? What is there for us? So I believe that building peace dividends, in packaging it in the peace process, helps. You also need your own intelligence or information to be able to know who is doing what. Because I think we get caught up, if you do not have this means of finding out who is doing what, you wake up one day and the carpet has been pulled from underneath your feet. And how do you deal with spoilers? How can you make them promoters of peace as opposed to spoiling the peace process? I'm simply throwing some of this at you to start thinking as some of the challenges in the mediation. And I'm sure this is not peculiar only to northern Uganda. Involvement of the international community, I also realize, is very, very important. On the one hand, government would complain that it legitimizes the rebels, but on the one hand, it attracts rebels because they believe then the international community is involved, and that adds into reassuring them about their own security and possibly means of livelihood. It's very, very important for the government in particular to see that its interest in what is going on is addressed and protected, because this is what basically has swayed the president of Uganda to seek to agree to a peaceful solution as opposed to military option only, because he has seen his own interest or the interest of the country being protected. And I think on that note, I'll end in here, and we'll welcome questions. Thank you.
I think you'll all agree with me that was an extraordinary assessment of the situation and reflections on Betty's long and very valuable experience as a mediator in northern Uganda. We do have time for questions. We have a microphone set up over here. If you would go to the microphone and stand in line, we'll take your questions in turn. Do you want to sit down or do you want to stand?
I want to stand.
Okay. Yes, I'll be here.
Thank you very much. Al-Bakir Mukhtar, A senior fellow with the USIP. Last year's senior fellow with the USIP. And I'm from Sudan. Thank you, Bettye, for your presentation. You told us about the circumstances around these talks on mediations, but you didn't mention the contents of the talks. If the LRA, they don't have any political agendas, what are they saying? I mean, what are the contents of the talks? What are their concerns? What do they want the government of Uganda to do, other than just securing their own security? And also, my second question is about the ICC. You projected the ICC either as a pressure to persuade the LRA to talks or to dissuade them to talk. And it looks like you sometimes feel that the ICC is a hindrance or an obstacle to talks. And also, you look like suggesting that the ICC indictment could be dropped as a trade-off or as something that that convince the LRA to conclude the peace talk. So, is it part of the talks that if LRA make peace with the Ugandan government, then they are not going to be indicted? Is this part of the talks? Thanks.
She'll take two or three more, and then she'll answer them all together.
I guess this is a follow-up to the previous question. But, it's my understanding you've said that historically the LRA hasn't had a political agenda, but it is my understanding that they are now trying to position themselves as representatives of the Acholi people at the talks, and I wondered if you could speak to whether that is accurate or not, and what is it specifically that they're asking for regarding economic and development situation in northern Uganda.
Hi, I'm Corky Bryant, and I want to thank you for an extraordinarily rich and wonderful talk. I have two questions. The first is that you said very little about the amnesty process. While in Uganda this last summer, I was quite surprised by the amount of support it seemed to have, but how complicated it was vis-a-vis the ICC issues. And yet there did seem to be increasing popular support for it among several key people. So I wondered your thoughts on that. The second is this very complicated issue that there really are very deep grievances, as you know, that the North has. Some of those have begun to be addressed, that is to say, get more attention. Some people think of it, of the war as not, or without remembering all the history, and having traveled throughout the North extensively in much earlier part of my career, I saw real reason for grievances. The one group that you also didn't mention in that regard is the Acholi religious leaders, because the Acholi religious leaders have positioned themselves as a different, albeit, I suppose, one of the confusing additional mediators. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on those two things, the amnesty and the Acholi religious leaders, as well as the linkages back to the grievances.
David Shin, George Washington University. Could you expand on the remark you made about non-governmental organizations benefiting from the continuation of the war? And more precisely, could you give some examples of the names of NGOs that you think fall in this category? and whether they're doing this sort of wittingly or unwittingly. I'm sure that they mean well when they are carrying out these grants, but this is a very important area, and not much has been said about it. And anything you could add to it, I think, would be useful. Thank you.
Hi, Carrie Stefanski from the Global Youth Partnership for Africa. I'm wondering, recognizing, as you said, the culture of power enjoyed by the LRA leadership to date, if CONI and LRA leaders were to accept an amnesty deal as part of the Juba talks, how could the government in Uganda and the international community keep CONI and LRA leaders from exercising their power and their influence, as former Liberian President Charles Taylor did from his sort of cozy safe haven in Nigeria? And if you would rely mainly on the ICC to serve as a deterrence to that?
First of all, thank you for the questions. But let me clarify a few things. In that, because of the limited time, there are a lot of details that I have had to leave out in the hope that when I write my book, you will want to read it. You will want to read it and find out many more details that I have had to leave out. The first question is the concerns of LRA since they do not have any political agenda. As you have heard, I've been dealing with LRA for quite some time, and it's very difficult to mediate when somebody does not have an agenda to put on the table. And so repeatedly, what are the issues that you want addressed in the talks? And I heard this from Kony himself twice. I heard this from his second in command, and at the time, Kola, who was their official mediator. Don't worry, I don't want to be president. I want to preach, I want to heal people using herbs, and then the concerns where I would like to see that is addressed is my personal security. That has been consistent all the time. And this spills over to the second question that, the third question, I think. The second question is that, are they trying to immediately try to craft some political agenda? Yes, and that, if you listen to what I say, one of the challenges or what raises a lot of questions is how representative is the group in Juba of the group, the fighters in the bush. They have, from time to time, contradicted one another. The group in Juba has come out with a very elaborate political program, and what I called, and I will continue to say that, unrealistic demands. It's like, disband the army. We want share of power so that the north and northeastern Uganda have 40% of the population. These are elected governments. Uganda has gone through a constitution writing process, and you cannot start making these demands, especially if the fighters earlier on did not put it as an issue to them. So it is true, and if you read Ugandan paper, reaction from even politicians from northern Uganda, who are, by the way, in the opposition, they also say it is totally unrealistic, some of these demands. It cannot be accommodated. One day, you're mutilating lips. You're killing people in the most brutal manner. And then the next day, you say, we want these same people to share power. It does not make a lot of sense. So, of course, there's speculation. This I do not know. I'm reporting what I hear, is that these other people in Juba are opportunistic. They're using this to get themselves jobs or some economic benefit out of the process. So I think the two questions, the first and second, kind of tie up in that, yes, there's an effort by the Juba team. We do not know how well the group, the fighters who are in the bush, believe in that, but from time to time they have contradicted some of these demands. At one time, the group in Juba said, no, 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 we don't want amnesty. And the bush, the group in the bush said, no, 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 we have already accepted amnesty. So which is which? We do not know. Yeah, in regards to ICC, what I have said, and I repeat what I said earlier on, is that, yes, ICC at the moment is being viewed largely by, you know, that it is a hindrance to the peace process. But at the same time, without the arrest warrant, LRA would not be under pressure to talk seriously. So it is a stick. But and LRA is using this opportunity very, by the way, I think they're very, very smart, because they come out with conditions, no peace unless the arrest warrant is dropped. So that, you know, everybody comes up and says priority to peace. We're all saying priority to peace. But also setting a precedent where this arrest warrant is dropped, then what do you do with impunity in future? What happens? So there are no straight answers to this, the question of ICC. As far as I'm concerned, it is important to wait to see how the situation evolves and then probably take time to debate and build consensus as to what is best. I personally believe that the victims need to be talked to. I talked about spending some time in the camps, where some people are certainly would be extremely happy to see these people in the docks. Okay. So it's sometimes very difficult to know who is really advocating for dropping of the arrest warrant. Is it that person who has lost 6 children, or is that person who has lost parents whose lips have been cut off or amputated, or is it somebody who is sitting somewhere in town? We're saying, I do not question the desire for peace, but it's also very important to see how this can be balanced. Justice and peace can be balanced. There's no quick fixes, no straight answers. I believe that building consensus on what should be done is the best at this point in time. If LRA makes peace with Uganda government, ICC is not obliged to respect that amnesty. At the moment, there's a blanket amnesty by the government of Uganda, but ICC is not obliged to respect that. ICC will still continue with the arrest warrant. But they also do not want to be seen as an obstacle to peace. They also think their credibility would be at stake if they went ahead and did something now, because everybody will say, you know, this is you're undermining peace. What to you it is a job. For the Choli people, they're living the real hardship and the danger, the difficulty. So it's a difficult situation. I think I answered question number three, which was LRA trying to position themselves to craft out a political agenda. Yes, it's like disbanding the army, sharing of power, and which to many people, and I'm talking about the local people, just believe it's unrealistic to make some of these demands. Yes, there are deep grievances. In fact, what I look at the peace process in Juba as just one bit of what can bring sustainable peace in northern Uganda. I look at reconciliation as a major component. That should be a major component of this process. We're looking at reconciliation at the grassroots level, the intra-Choli reconciliation, where LRA members have come back and brutalized members of their own community. We're also looking at the bigger one, where the region, the neighboring districts, have also borne the brunt of the war, and they're angry, and they're looking at it as the Cholis are not stopping their children from fighting, and they're hurting us. You're looking also nationally. I think government should provide a forum for the people of northern Uganda to be able to spit out what is in their chest. They felt marginalized, they felt brutalized, they felt, and indeed, what I told President Museveni at one time is that people believe you do not want to end the war because you're very powerful, you're very strong. How can you not end this war? This is just, you say, a gang of bandits. Why are you not doing it? So so they feel he doesn't want to end the war. But when you also look at it, there are real problems in ending this war. There's no pattern to it. So I believe reconciliation will address some of these underlying causes of the war in northern Uganda, and hopefully will realize sustainable peace. On the question of NGOs, oh, before I jump into that, yeah, I'm sorry if I did not mention actually religious leaders, because I think when I was talking about different initiatives, I talked about the Carter Center, actually religious leaders initiative, and a presidential team. I think I did mention that. No, they're doing some commendable job. There's no doubt about that. It's just I couldn't go into a lot of details as to what they're doing. The other thing is NGOs benefiting from the war. And civil society organizations. I do not want to differentiate, and I'm not going to mention names, but I've said this on many forums. There are NGOs that are doing commendable job. And indeed, they've stepped in the place of government. People actually look to them as government because whether it's services, whatever is being done. But there are also lots of NGOs who are going in circles and just hosting seminars and recycling the same people. It's very easy to write a proposal and get some funding if you're going to host a seminar. So what one would see after all this is some practical activities. Because if you give me a job, if it's a job for me, certainly I will go out and fundraise to be able to do what I have, to keep my job. And if it is just going to be seminars, then it will be seminars. I'm not condemning NGOs, but I think what we need to do, or I'm not accusing them of being corrupt, but I could also talk about many local NGOs, what is known locally as briefcase NGOs, who are getting money, and they're not doing anything. It's a means of livelihood for them. And as I said, and not in bad faith, that some of the initiatives by civil society organizations have been living off the conflict. They're not undermining it, but they're not comfortable because suddenly their means of livelihood is taken away from them. So I do hope you understand what I'm trying to explain in all this. The last question was the power of culture. What can keep CON away from exercising the same power if and when he gets out? I think it would be a completely different environment. You should see, as former LRAs told me one time, that you need to know how we are programmed in the bush to see how you can deprogram us. Okay, that means, in fact, when you sit with former LRAs, you know, if you offer them food, if you don't start eating, they will not start. They're so used to order that they cannot do anything outside it. But when they get out, it's a different environment. They can learn to think for themselves, and they can then do things for themselves. So I would not worry about that. I don't think it would be an issue.
Yeah, I'm Colonel Charles Angina, the defense advisor for Uganda here in Washington and also in Canada.
And I also worked with him.
Yeah. Yeah, I thank God that we have got opportunity again to share the same hall and same audience with the Honorable Betty Bigombe. I hold her with high esteem because of commitment and the risks she took in order to try to bring peace in northern Uganda. And that peace is a peace that we shall all treasure when finally we get it. My question is in line with trying to remind the Honorable Bigombe that we need some records to be put straight, then it will help us in getting proper solution. Because I believe once we get to know the truth, then the truth can set us free, and it will also be a halfway solving the problem. One aspect that is very apparent is that in the past, as she said, Joseph Kony and his so-called Lord Resistance Army were not genuine in the effort of peace resolution. And the peace talk policy of our government, which I'm sure it's just a reminder to us, it started a long time ago where we used both military action and peace talks. And that culminated in the first talks in the Peche Stadium, where we had Angelo Kelo with the bishop signing. So that policy was there back. It was not during the time when Honorable Beth Bigombe was made the minister for Northern Uganda. That policy has been there, and I'm sure she can be able to put more light into that. But the challenges she faced that made it become very difficult for her to achieve that initial and very difficult undertaking, and I'm proud about her because she took the risk which many people wouldn't have taken, and she became a man among us men, and she was able to move a step ahead to try to reach Kony. She took that initiative, and we respect it. But then at that time, she needs to put this audience into light that behind the scene there was Osama bin Laden, who is still a problem to the world today. He was in Juba, hosted by Hassan Turabi. So if you see that force that was behind the scene, you should be able to know that the problem was bigger than what Honorable Betty Bigombe was faced. She was looking at the ordinary Joseph Kony, a village boy who has grown up to become a myth within Northern Uganda. But there was another force behind that situation at that particular time, which I would do request that she puts more light into it, so that you go more in the picture of that situation. Two, the second effort she undertook again in bringing an end to this effort through peaceful means, the person Kony selected himself to be the representative of Lord Resistance Army was forced to run back to us who are supposed to be their enemy through Honorable Betty Bigombe to surrender, because Kony was not consistent, was not genuine. So Sam Kolo, who was the representative, was again saved by Betty Bigombe by us rescuing him from the one who had sent him to represent the whole Lord Resistance Army. So I believe that is another area that we need to put light, so that they know that maybe this time in Juba is getting cornered because of the pressure from ICC and also having limited support from the Arabs who have been behind it with the so-called the support was getting from these other groups outside Sudan. Apparently, I would request that I submit that the following made this war in northern Uganda to be taking up to about 20 years. She's right to say that in UPDF we had our own weaknesses, but she's not correct to say the entire military was having huge benefit and that's why we didn't want the war to end. No. She knows the risks I was taking. She knows, and I'm part of that institution. Surely we did the best we could, but there was a bigger force. Sudan was fully behind Lord Resistance Army because they wanted to use Lord Resistance Army to fight behind their lines, behind the SPLA lines, to make sure that the SPLA does not succeed to make success. SPLA is the force that was under the late John Garang. So they wanted that force to continue to be a force that can fight behind the SPLA lines to make them achieve what they wanted. So that was one big factor. And today that aspect is not there because of the effort this country did in causing Sudan government to have peace with SPLA. Two was the issue of Osama bin Laden and Hassan Turabi. They wanted to spread Islamic fundamentalism. They didn't want the Christianity in southern Sudan, and they thought they would succeed. They are spread to Uganda, to Kenya, and down south. They wanted to take all that territory. And that explains what happened in the attack of the U.S. embassy in Nairobi and in Dar es Salaam. It happened on the same day and was supposed to happen even in Kampala. But because for us we were already on a terrorist alert, they were not able to succeed in Kampala, but they succeeded in the other two embassies, in Kenya and in Dar es Salaam. That is the program of Osama bin Laden and Hassan Turabi. So all that force was in place. The other aspect that made this war to go on for very long, it is the budget constraint. Our country is a country that had been put to nothing by Idi Amin and other past leaders. So when President Museveni took over, he had to rely on the donor friends. And these donor friends had to control the budget. They had to say, this amount goes to defense, this amount goes to education and the other ministries. So it was a limitation in the aspect of how we could buy the capabilities that can be able to deal with these groups. The initial groups, she can stand with me and testify, we fought other groups, over 20 other different groups, and we defeated them. But they did not have the force of Osama bin Laden, Hassan Turabi, and the other support that they were having from outside to make it be very difficult for us to end it. And that's the reason why it took this too long. For instance, even in eastern Uganda, we had a group that we had to talk and at the same time use the military effort. And she knows about the UPA. You know about how the members of UPA, through the talks today, some of them are ministers, whom I salute. Musa Echweru was one of those fellows, was the shadow minister of defense for the UPA.
He surrendered in my hand.
He's renting your house, you see.
Surrendered to me.
Okay, so all this confirms what I'm saying. And then the other aspect that made this war to go along, also the element of collaborators. There are some leaders within our people, both in northern Uganda and other parts of Uganda, who are allied to support the Lord's Resistance Army. If you followed the recent development, they were able to be called, or they've been able to move into Garama National Park to go and see their hero, to go and embrace their hero. This is not a person people would be tracking to go and see. He's been a murderer and so forth. But those who have been collaborating with him have been behind it. And for us, we are faced with the challenge as military people to go and destroy this enemy in the midst of children that have abducted. So you try as much as possible to see how you can save these children. And in the process, you miss an opportunity to end the rebellion at once, because you have to separate the enemy from the children that were abducted. So people should be able to appreciate that there was something difficult than the previous groups who have fought.
I think we want to hear the other questions too. So
okay, so okay, let me finalize with this aspect of question also. The final question is on the question of superstition. I believe that there's more strength of superstition in northern Uganda, which Kony has taken advantage of, which Alice Lakwena took advantage of. But the fight we have had with Kony and the so-called Lord Resistance Army has been basically of actual fighting with the guns, mines, and the support weapons that they were getting from Sudan. But they did not use the stones. That one you have to correct it. Stone was Alice Lakwena. But for Kony, he has been equipped properly. So maybe you put that one right, Honorable Betty Gombe. Thank you very much, and God bless you.
Thank you.
Hello. Good afternoon. I just want to first of all say thank you very much for coming to speak with us. I really appreciate what you've been doing thus far in Uganda, and definitely Africa needs more people like you who are willing to take personal risks in order to achieve peace and, at the same time, good governance. I have a few questions. First of all, I just wanted to ask, for ordinary citizens, especially like Ugandans in the diaspora, and as well perhaps Ugandans within Uganda, what role, if any, do you see in their efforts towards promoting the peace process? And how can they become involved in that? And also I wanted to ask, I recently finished a book about a group of abducted children in Gulu, the Aboke girls, from a Catholic school in the area. And one of the issues that was raised in the book was when children came home after being in the field for several years as child soldiers, how are they received into their communities? And I just wanted to know, do you know of any attempt to, or any procedures where, or even programs that are trying to reabsorb these children as functioning members of the community? And is there any efforts to have like psychologists or psychiatrists to help foster healing between people who've lost children to the child soldiers, and as well children who've come back and who have participated in killings in the very communities that they're coming back to? Yeah, that's all. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Dennis Okello. I'm an intern at the Stimson Center. I have two quick questions. There seems to be consensus, this is the first question, that peace is the imperative right now. But there's also that recognition that justice has to be done, that impunity can go unpunished. You just talked about your mediating efforts, the two efforts that you had, and that one of the key concerns of Joseph Kony was his own protection. So I'm wondering, as a mediator, how you handle that, knowing that you just said it, that impunity can't go unpunished, knowing the crimes he's committed. How do you go about reassuring him so he can sign up to some sort of agreement? And then two, you said also that you think that this current process will lead to some sort of agreement being signed without knowing what the content of that agreement will be. Can you say generally what could be done to ensure that it's effectively implemented? Because that, you said, the implementation will be the test of that. So can you speak just generally about what could be done to ensure that if there's an agreement, it can be effectively implemented? Thank you.
Hi, my name is Angel Tabe. I'm a reporter with the Voice of America. I'm still concerned about the role of those NGOs that you mentioned benefit from conflict. In a continent that is, you know, really synonymous to poverty, and looking at the resources that are put into a conflict after it erupts, what is the obstacle between prevention and conflict prevention and conflict resolution? Is it those NGOs or those organizations that are aspiring to benefit from conflict that are putting bottlenecks? Because this conflict, when it started, someone in Ugandans knew about it, they talked about it. What prevented, you know, why could it not be prevented? And looking at the resources that go into it now.
My name is Frank Jarrett from Sierra Leone, initially from Freetown, Sierra Leone. I'm here as an independent observer. I must of all congratulate you on your presentation. It's very interesting. And I found out that most of the narratives you went through were very, very similar to what happened in Sierra Leone, up to the point when Fodi Sanko signed the agreement and then negated the agreement. And if I'm going back, what the problems you negated about what happened in the bush, about communication, that somebody won cell phone, and also must congratulate you on your bravery for you to be alone in that place and for you to be counted amongst the rest of the, the LRA people negotiating with them, and the determination which you had to get you to this position today. And my point is, what I want to know is that how much communication was there that you think would enhance the conflict? In other words, how do you see the role of ICT in this, your conflict, to further sustain your achievement and to build up on future peace talks? Thank you.
Hi, Hi, I'm Ginny Bouvier. I'm here at the Jennings Randolph Fellowship Program at the Institute. And I'd like to say, first of all, that we feel very privileged to be able to support your work and are delighted to have you here with us at the Institute. I have two questions. The first goes back to your mentioning the limited agenda of the LRA. And I'm wondering how, as a mediator, you put your own hidden agenda of Acholi grievances onto the table if you don't have a party that's actually asking you to put those there. So I wonder if you could reflect a little bit on that. And my second question relates to your position as a woman. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the strengths and the liabilities that being a woman has brought to the mediation process.
This will be our last question. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Shelby Haskins, and I'm an intern at World Vision. And I actually have a similar question to the last question. Specifically, I'm looking at, lately, the role of women in this conflict. And I'd be really curious if you're willing, and as much as you feel comfortable, to speak to your personal struggle, maybe internal thoughts as you were going through these talks, and how you would encourage other women in the United States or women in Uganda to get involved, and just talk to those personal struggles and how you overcame those struggles. Thank you.
Colonel Amina, thank you very much, and thank you for coming here today. When I was appointed Minister for Pacification of North and Northeastern Uganda, my instruction was talk to the Acholi people to persuade their children to give up fighting. And it is in writing, so that cannot be disputed. I'm not saying there was no policy for peace talks in the government of Uganda. My instructions were very, very clear. And when I eventually realized that the war was not going to end militarily and opted for peace talks and made contacts with the rebels directly and told the president what was going on and therefore persuaded him to accept this option, the instruction was again very clear, negotiate for surrender. So that's what it is. I'm very much aware, and I did participate in the peace talks with UPDA in 1987. Regarding probably what you think is labeling UPDF benefiting from the war, I cannot name names here. Again, I'll refer you when I write. There will be a Colonel Q, a Colonel B, the names will be there. It's not that the entire army was doing that. In fact, if anything, I opted for talks with the Lord's Resistance Army because I had been tipped off by some UPDA officers who said, we are not going anywhere. We have a huge problem. So that just explains to you that it's not that the whole army was involved or benefiting from the conflict. But certainly, as you acknowledged, there were some who were benefiting from the conflict. The belief that it was Alice Lakwena's forces only that was using stones. My humble advice to you is when you're next back home, spend time with some of the commanders who have come out of the bush recently. And these stories, I've been trying to try to understand the spirit element. And this is coming directly from them. They totally believe. You have Onen Kamdulu, who says he's a colonel, who tells you how your hand shakes and moves when you're carrying those stones. So it's directly from them. The people in the diaspora, whether Ugandans or non-Ugandans, what can they do to the process? I think it's very... 3 weeks ago, there was Uganda Lobby Day, and our message was extremely clear that we need international support in the peace process. The government has already made commitment. LRA has gone further than it has ever done. the signing of cessation of hostilities is very important. So our message was a government like the U.S. needs to say something that they support it, even if it's not material support, but just to say that we support the process, to give that political support would help. And the same thing coming from the diaspora is just as helpful. In fact, what saddens me is that I'm informed, and again, I cannot substantiate, that some of the diaspora are working against the peace process. They are such strong Museveni's haters that they look at the war as a damage to Museveni and not looking at the people. So how can we get the diaspora to speak with one voice and say that we support the process? And also try to give correct advice, because a lot of times some of the advice that go to LRA is totally distorted and it's not in the interest of peace. The other question was whether I do not know whether these clocks are correct. That peace is imperative. What protection would one provide for coin? At the time I was talking with him, the five had been indicted, but the arrest warrants had not yet been issued. So I discussed with them. I offered examples of what was offered to the RENAMO leader in Mozambique, you know, for LRA to see which one would work best for him. I brought one from Cambodia, was Ivory Coast, and also at that time Charles Taylor of Liberia had not yet been arrested. So it was to discuss what worked best for them, because in this, it's not by word of mouth. You want them to participate in telling you what would convince them, what can assure them that their security is taken care of. So it was a matter of saying, this is what was done in Mozambique to the RENAMO leader, who was just as brutal, but the kind of protection that was provided for him, looked at what was going on in Ivory Coast at that time, looked at what happened in Cambodia. I think I had five different countries. The fifth one, I forget which the fifth one was, but it's basically to engage them in deciding what kind of security they want. So that's how we were working on assuring coin. But at that time, you also need to know that they had not yet relocated to Congo. The arrest warrant, therefore, had not been issued. So there was still room to get this done. There was room also because I was equally discussing with ICC what could work and what couldn't work. Would the idea of them going into exile, especially after talking to Coin directly, who said, you know, I know my fate. I have only three options. It is death, it's exile, and prison. So I said, why don't you take the third, exile? So we also discussed that. Which country could take them in? And if not, what assurance is there, especially in the absence of arrest warrant, that ICC would not want to have an agreement with country X to be able to arrest them in future? Because you also don't want your word, as a mediator, it's very important that if you promise them something, then it has to be done. Otherwise, you lose your own credibility. So I was just as much concerned that should we negotiate for exile, would ICC not negotiate for exile with a country that has no agreement with ICC, would ICC not follow them? This was in process as we talked. What kind of agreement can be made to ensure implementation? What can be done to ensure implementation of the agreement? I think, again, in here, how can you hold the parties to their promises, to what they have signed on? And to a large extent, I think government is on the higher ground as far as implementation of peace agreement is concerned. But government would not do it alone. Government would, one, need pressure, two, resources. Again, you need to fall back onto the international community that if we are going to realize sustainable peace, we have to absolutely have the agreements honored and implemented. I think the next question was asking whether is it NGOs that promote wars so that they can benefit. Now, I repeat myself. Yeah, you're right over there. There's some NGOs who are doing commendable job, international and local. But there are all others. There are also others. I'm not saying they're promoting war. What I'm saying is that they may not play a crucial role anymore if their source of livelihood is undermined. But it also, in the same vein, I would want to say that wars create jobs. But if they are good jobs that serve the real purpose, why not? If it is genuine, with commitment. There are very, very many NGOs who take risky journeys in northern Uganda to supply humanitarian assistance. So I do not say that they promote jobs, but they may not be very much interested in the peace process. I did not say that they would undermine the process, but I say that they may not support it like you would want to see it happen. One question that I didn't understand was about the community. How much community should do? We'll ask that question. Okay. Yep. You know, this we need to engage the Institute of Peace so that we talk more about prevention. Indeed, one of the things I experienced in mediation is that it's very difficult to mobilize resources for mediation. The international community will very easily fund humanitarian assistance, not to a large extent, but they're much more reluctant to give money to end the war. And this is something I've not been able to understand, this mentality. If I walk in at the same time with somebody who is trying to mobilize resources for humanitarian assistance, he or she is likely to have longer conversation, will see something. I'm not saying it is wrong, but there's less attention or less investment in prevention or addressing the problems that end conflicts. And I hope that more and more we pay attention to that. In my experience, it was very, very difficult. You explained until your voice was sore why you needed certain funds, for example, to conduct a certain exercises. So it is a big problem. Putting the grievances of the Acholi people, I go back to what I said earlier on, in that I think reconciliation is imperative. It is imperative. It is. It will address the underlying causes of the conflict. What is going on in Juba is reaching an agreement, and where we question whether the agreements will be questioned. But what I would like to see is that the intra-Acholi reconciliation takes place. At the moment, fathers of child mothers who have returned from rebels are being thrown away by their own families. They're ashamed of them. Maybe at one time they came and killed, and community is hostile towards the whole family. And a father says, I cannot stand the children of the killers around my home. Get out. So reconciliation has to go into within families, within neighbors, within community. It's very important. Then looking at it regionally, if I had the map of Uganda here, I would show you where LRA went, other neighboring tribes that also bore the brunt of the war, where the children were abducted, they were killed and maimed. So also to have that unity address some of the problems regionally, sub-region within northern Uganda, there is need for a reconciliation program. And the third one is national, because you also have complaints where Ugandan army hurt ordinary people, and these needs to be addressed. These are grievances which are very, very deep that have generated resentment for the government. So if you had a national reconciliation program, then it would address such grievances. At least people will be able to speak out, and something will come out of it that can put their minds at peace. And I believe people will then feel they have been they're mainstreamed in the government systems. They're no longer marginalized. Yes, strength and liability of being a woman. Indeed, I did not mention this, but I think the first initiative of 92-94, being a woman, worked against me. In the first, even just as I went in, I remember I was extremely frightened, because the first letter was from the rebels who were saying, well, they were saying that it was an insult that Museveni would send a woman to deal with a matter of this. You know, this is male domain. What are you doing here? The second letter was, if you don't leave, we will kill you. We know exactly where you're staying. So, but in all this was a woman. And I would say that it is not just the rebels. It's the community themselves. To them, it was lack of seriousness on the part of the governor of Museveni to send a woman. And at that time, I was younger, so they said a girl. So, which was very flattering. So, it made people more curious. They really wanted to see if you could do certain things. You're very visible in every respect, whether you're talking to the rebels, you're talking to government, the government side too. I had many friends, men and women, who thought I should not take up the job. I was going to be killed, and maybe there were plans to kill me. Should not take it up. You're a woman. You're not militarily trained. This was an all-out war situation. So, but I would say it also worked in my favor. There were so many things that I think women are generally patient in a situation like this. Sometimes you could be dying with anger, but it remains there, and it doesn't. You don't show it. So, and exhibiting patience and courage. And some people started, it worked in my favor. If she can do it, why not me? If even a woman can do it, if she can do it, why would it? Why would I not do it? So there were, I would say, pros and cons. The first time it worked against me, I think very, very strongly, because the spoilers, especially as we were making progress in the peace process, some of the issues was just a mere woman to do this. We cannot accept it. We have to undermine it. So it did work against me. The second time, there was already a track record. So the element of being a woman did not come very much. It's just, how could I get more women to play more roles in the process? It helped also to get more women to come out in the open and support the process. And I remember the first time was a huge demonstration by women that I organized, and that was covered by BBC and everybody, where I said, you're the wives, you're the mothers, you're going to be widows, you're going to lose your sons. Let's come out on the street and demonstrate against the war. So I also did discover that women are more practical in terms of implementing what has been agreed upon, rather than men who talk beautiful words, but it remains there. The internal struggle was very strong, because I have a family. I had a husband who passed away and two children, that I could not spend time with them. And indeed, for a long time, it was a problem, especially with my daughter, who was very, very young when I took up the responsibility, and all the years, whether she was being baptized, if it was her birthday, whatever ceremony, I didn't go to school to visit. So she kind of grew up thinking that, you know, your career is more important than your own family. Although later she started understanding and appreciating what is that it was important, that if anything she was privileged, and I was trying to get the other children like her to also live a normal life. But in all I can tell you, it's not very easy to balance it. You have to make sacrifices somewhere. Thank you.